This will be a continuation of my talk yesterday, but since perhaps not everybody was there, and also for the people who were there, it might be good to give a short summary of what we have been looking at. So I was looking at B model, so-called B model topological strings, which is somehow equivalent to quantizing kind of Calabi-Yau threefold. And the particular class that we were interested in were kind of hypersurfaces in C4 of the following type. So we had the equation ZW plus some function h of x and y equal to 0. And these varieties had a holomorphic three form that could be picked to be dz, dx, dy over z. So looking at this particular class of geometries, and then we reduced the problem to the following. So by looking at this manifold as a vibration over the xy plane, then we have a complex plane algebraic curve lying here, which is the curve h equals 0, and that was the place where the vibration became singular. And then at least at the classical level, where variations of Calabi-Yaus are written in terms of variation of the complex structure, and therefore variations of this holomorphic 3-0 form. So what we then could reduce the whole problem to a Riemann surface sigma, which is the one, is the Riemann surface given by the equation hxy equals 0. But it's important, it's not just the Riemann surface itself that we're varying, we're really varying it as a equation inside this complex plane, so really as a plane curve. And the holomorphic three-form, which was living on the Calabi-Yau threefold, we could reduce to a one-form, a meromorphic one-form, living on sigma. So we've got also a meromorphic one-form that actually was given by yx dx. So these were kind of the data that we finally were able to reduce everything down to. So we're looking at variations of these structures. So the picture is, in general, we're looking kind of at families of algebraic curves. So here is kind of, we think of the function y of x. And we, what I showed is that if we want to vary these structures, we want to think of the one form, at least the variations of this one form, we want to think of an exact one form, so we get a naturally function phi. And then the claim was, so the claim that the full string theory makes this kind of field d phi a quantum field. So that means the following thing, in particular if we expand it in mode expansions. So we think of expanding phi here locally in terms of a Lorentz series. Then we have a quantum relation that is the operators alpha n and alpha m satisfies canonical quantization condition with some parameter which we call g string. Actually, yeah, g string squared here, and dn plus m, comma 0. Yes? So, I mean, there's the old genus contributions. So, the genus 0 contributions will give this classical variation problem, classical Hodge theory in some sense of these curves, families of algebraic curves. And then we say, well, what do we do if you include the higher genus contributions, and then somehow this gets quantized? So we'll go back to this, but first I want to show you how these structures in a natural way emerge from matrix models. So this is in some sense, I will be reviewing kind of work which by now to some of you might be quite familiar, but for those of you who haven't seen this, I think it's interesting to briefly go through it and see how these structures are coming out of matrix models. So there we do the following thing. So the starting point is we pick some polynomial. So say W of X is some polynomial. Say, and we consider it to kind of be of degree, I will pick it of degree d plus 1. But it's quite important that we, even if we, in some sense, your the degree, you shouldn't really think of it to be fixed, because in some sense we want to consider arbitrary families of the polynomial. So this degree can be arbitrary high. And also, I want to think of the tn's as complex variables. And then we want to consider the following integral. So the matrix integral is the following integral. It's the integral d phi. Let me first write it. So it's an integral over n by n matrix. So we integrate over an n by n matrix. In standard matrix integrals, you pick phi to be a Hermitian matrix. But here I want to be phi an n by n complex matrix. And what we are integrating over, we are integrating over a cycle. So that's the space clearly of complex dimension n squared. And we want to integrate over a cycle which is half the dimension. So, for instance, gamma r, there could be the set of Hermitian matrices. So where psi dagger equals psi. So that's like integrating over the real axis. But in general, that's not what you want to do, because think of even this as just a one-dimensional integral. So this will be some polynomial with certain coefficients, and you want somehow this integral to make sense. So you want to pick the contour in such a way that this integral does kind of converge for large values of phi. So in general, we have some contour in the complexified complex space. And so this will depend on a set of data. So this integral will depend on the rank of the matrix, on this coefficient gs here, and of the coefficients tn that appear in the polynomial w. So this is and we also write this as exponent of f, f being the free energy. And then the claim is, okay, let me do something more. So now we can do kind of the saddle point approximation. So that's an expansion in this variable GS. So that's the limit. You take the limit GS to 0. And the claim is then that this function F has an expansion of the following form, GS to the power 2G minus 2. Fg. Well, in order to make sense of this expansion, I also want to send n to infinity, so let me try to explain that now. So how do you do this integral? So these are standard techniques in matrix integrals, but let me just go briefly through with it. So you assume, so let's assume for the moment that phi is Hermitian. Then we can diagonalize it, so we can write phi as u times some diagonal matrix, U inverse, and write then the measure of phi in terms of the measure on the unitary group. So here U is a unitary matrix. And in terms of the eigenvalues, and that's a classical combination, what you find the higher measure on the unitary group, then you find just the standard measure on these n eigenvalues, just a standard measure on Rn, and then you get the factor, which is the famous van der Monde determinant, so delta of lambda is the product I less than j, lambda I minus lambda j squared. So that's just a rather simple computation. And then you can rewrite this. Sorry? Oh, no, sorry. No square here. Thank you. And so that means that the integral z can be written. Oh, and I should also have said that here I want to write a quotient of, I want to kind of divide here. There's a natural action here of the unitary group, and I want to kind of divide by the volume of this unitary group. So that means that we can kind of cancel off the measure coming from integrating over un, and then finally this is written as an integral over these n eigenvalues, the van der Monde squared, and then there's the exponential function. which, since now the matrix phi can be diagonalized, this is just the sum Tn, the eigenvalues, log the I to the power n. So if you want to do this integral in a stationary phase approximation, you first want to look at its critical points. So what are the critical points? Well, critical points are very easy, because the critical points just means that each individual eigenvalue should be at a critical point of our polynomial. So we get the following picture. Here is our function w. And for each eigenvalue, we have to decide at which critical point it lies. Right, so each eigenvalue sits at one of these points. So what we have to do, so w will have d critical points, say let's call them a1 up to ad, and then we have to make a partition of n, the total rank of the matrix, in terms of d benches. And each, so here ni is the number of eigenvalues. So there are some eigenvalues, say lambda j, which are equal to at the ith critical point. So the point is that the eigenvalues are distributed. So there are n1 here, n2 here, n3 here, etc. So that's the critical point. And now we want to take a limit. So the limit we want to take is the limit where we send the rank to infinity. And not only the rank to infinity, we want to send this individual, as they're called, filling fractions, so the number of eigenvalues at each critical point, also to infinity. But at the same time, we want to send our small parameter, which controls the asymptotic expansion, to zero. And we want to keep the combinations ni, gs, which I will call si, we want to keep them fixed. So that's the limit that we want to take. And in that limit, the asymptotic expansion of this function will now be a function of these parameters. So we have these expansions fg being a function of d parameters, which are the parameters that control the number of eigenvalues at the individual fixed points. So this is the kind of the standard thing to do. And so how do you solve this? So this is a pretty well-known technique, but let me go through to it. So the thing that you do is you write the partition function z as an integral of some kind of effective action in terms of the n eigenvalues. And this action as effective is, of course, just the usual, the contribution coming from the original potential. And then there's the van der Monde determinant that we now actually add to the action. So it will look like 2 times g string, sum e less than j, log lambda I minus lambda j. And this means that you have, this is what I already explained in my first lecture, you have a bunch of particles moving in a potential w, oh sorry, no prime here. And there is an interaction between the eigenvalues, which is logarithmically. So this is the Coulomb-Gauss model. So how do you now proceed? Well, you proceed by looking at the classical. So we want to do the settle point approximation to leading order, at least. So what do we find? So let me, but before I do that, so introduce a little bit more notation. So what is the picture that you have? So this is the complex plane, say the complex plane, let's call the x-plane. And in that plane, so we are giving this polynomial w of x. And so that polynomial has critical points. And remember, in general, this is a complex polynomial, so it has some critical points here, a1, a2, up to ad. And then if you have a classical solution, a saddle point to our integral, there will be a bunch of eigenvalues, namely n1 sitting here, n2 sitting here, and nb sitting here. So they are all sitting here. That's kind of the classical picture. And one way to understand this is look at, we can now do the following thing, and that's actually very useful, and we'll see in a moment how we interpret this in string theory. We can say, let's add one more eigenvalue. So I put an eigenvalue, so we look like a matrix with n of rank n plus 1, and we have eigenvalues lambda 1 up to lambda n, and the next one we call x, but we do not integrate over x. So it's like a spectator. If you want, you have an ensemble of matrices, and you average over the first n eigenvalues, but you keep the last eigenvalue free. And then we can look at the effective action of this extra eigenvalue. So how does it look as two terms? It's, of course, the usual potential in which it moves. And then there's this logarithmic term that I want to write as follows. It's something like 2g string, and then it's the expectation value of the trace of the log of x minus phi, where this is this. The phi is the matrix which has eigenvalues lambda 1, lambda n. So now you say, what is the kind of force that's exerted on this eigenvalue? That means just what's the derivative of this action. So I introduce now one form, yx dx, which is this ds of effective, and that will be w prime of x plus 2g string trace of 1 over x minus phi. And this is the resolvent of the matrix. So there's a naturally one form associated to this matrix integral, which is this object over here. And then the question is, can we solve y of x? So this is a classical technique in the theory of matrix integrals, the so-called loop equation. And it goes as follows. So it's interesting to write this equation in terms of, so look at the equation of motion of the eigenvalues. So that takes the following form. The eigenvalues will solve the equation that they are a saddle point, and so they satisfy an equation of this type. Well, this is an equation we can use. On the other hand, we have the definition that y of x is w prime of x sum of I x minus lambda I. And now it's an exercise that I actually won't go through, that if you compute y of x squared, then you see that you have to you have various terms by just multiplying these factors. In particular, there's a factor where you square this, but then you can use this identity to simplify it. So you will find that this satisfies, at least in the limit where we send n to infinity, this we get an algebraic equation for y. In fact, it takes the following form. This turns out to be wx squared plus a function f of x. So remember, w was of degree d plus 1, so this is of degree 2d. And this function f turns out to be a polynomial of degree d, and this is its definition. So f of d of x is, by definition, the sum over I, w prime lambda I minus w prime x over lambda I minus x. And you can easily check that this is polynomial in x, because it has a root here. So it's a polynomial of degree d. Sorry, d minus 1. I'm sorry about that. It's a polynomial of degree d minus 1. And it's, in some sense, determined by the distributions of eigenvalues. So it's determined by the distribution of eigenvalues. And so by this kind of algebraic equation, and it's perhaps good to give some pictures of this, and then I'm done reviewing this piece of technology. So I'm sorry, I forgot to include here the factors of G string. I think if I'm correct, there's an overall factor of G string here, G string squared. In fact, the important thing is that if we put this G string to zero, what would that mean? Well, it means that if you look at the path integral, you forget about this whole logarithmic interaction. So G string to zero, this whole kind of measure of the van der Monde is ignored. And in that limit, clearly y of x is by definition just w prime. And that means that y squared is just w prime of x squared. That means that this correction here is absent. So let me draw this as a curve. So suppose, for instance, that w is quartic, then w prime will be some cubic function. But clearly this equation has solutions y equals w prime or y equals minus w prime. So if you draw it as a real curve, it looks something like this, and you can see that this is clearly a singular curve that has d double points. So these are double points. Now, what happens if we consider this limit where G string is not zero? So then for G string not zero, we get the equation y squared is w prime squared plus f, where this is degree minus 1. And clearly what is here is, here's a general polynomial of degree 2d. Right? So this is a polynomial that has kind of a degree d, and then we add the lower order piece. So here you have a general polynomial. What this means, this is just a general hyperelliptic curve. So what does that mean? That means that this picture here with double points now looks different. It looks now more like this. If you draw x and y, again, as a real slice, it will look something like this. Where here we have we have added branch points. So what happened is that these double points get split in the usual branch points. So indeed, so you have a general equation y squared is some product, say, of x minus alpha I, where the alphas here, so alpha 1 up to alpha 2d, are the branch points. So the claim is that now we get this general algebraic curve out. So I think that's already a very nice result, that just by looking at the saddle point approximation of a matrix model, you get an hyperelliptic curve. But not only do you get an hyperelliptic curve, you also have a very natural way in which the solution of the model is encoded in terms of precisely the data that we expect from a topological string theory. Namely, we have the following order. Remember that we have this one form, y dx. And that is clearly, so it's a one form on the Riemann surface now, sigma, given by that equation, y squared is w squared squared plus f. And how is the one form related to the solution of the matrix model? So now I want to draw it in the complex plane. So here's the complex x plane, as I've drawn it a moment ago. So remember, we started with having the critical points of our function w, but now these critical points are split up into branch points. So here are the branch points, alpha 1, alpha 2, up to alpha 2d. And we also have this one form, y dx, living on this Riemann surface. So it's a double curve, the Riemann surface double curve of the x-plane. And perhaps it's good also to draw it as an actual Riemann surface, and then it looks something like this. So now it has holes, and then there are little cycles here. So let me call these cycles A1, A2, A3. And these are now cycles surrounding, so this is, for instance, the cycle A1 viewed in the complex plane. And then there are dual cycles that kind of intersect the A cycle, so this is, for instance, the cycle B1, here there's the cycle B2, etc. And these can be viewed as follows. So you take some point, say, at infinity, you go like this in the x-plane. Of course, this moment you switch sheet, and then you go all the way again to infinity on the other sheet, and that's the cycle B1. So these are the usual homology cycles on a Riemann surface viewed as a double curve of the x-plane. And now the question is, what can you compute with these data? So there are two things that you have to realize. So the first point is that, so let me remind you the definition of the one form. So y dx was d of w plus 2g string trace 1 over x minus phi. So if you look here, you see it has a single pole at each eigenvalue. Right? Whenever you have an eigenvalue of the matrix, the resultant has exactly a pole. So this one form has poles at all the positions of the eigenvalues. So particularly if we integrate y dx, say, around the cycle ai, which is a little loop that originally surrounded the critical point where you put n eigenvalues, but now it's spread around to a little branch cut. So all these eigenvalues are now kind of spread out along this branch cut. What this does, it just kind of, by kind of Cauchy's theorem, it just computes up to a factor of 2 pi, it computes the number of these eigenvalues. In fact, there's this 2g string here, so we get also, so there's some suitable normalization. I think we have to divide by pi or something. And then it actually computes the number of eigenvalues times this small parameter, g string, you should always think about as kind of h bar. So what we are computing here is exactly this parameter si that we kept fixed in the large n expansion. So the periods around the a cycles are computing our parameters si, and this actually tells you how to translate from the si's versus this function, this polynomial of degree d minus 1 that I actually had not talked about. So this has some kind of expansion, fn x to the n, from n is 0 to d minus 1. So I didn't tell you how to determine this. I gave an a priori definition right upstairs. But in principle, there are d complex coefficients that you have to fix. But once you fix f, you fix the one form, you fix the Riemann surface, you can compute the period integrals. And so there is a way in which the Riemann surface determines its own periods. And that's the relation between the si's and these coefficients fn here. So there is the coefficients in f are indirectly determined by this condition. So this is just fixes for us now, once and for all, the Riemann surface. But now there's a second ingredient. So now I can ask, what happens if I integrate y dx around the non-compact cycle b? But that actually has a good interpretation, because remember, this is just the integral of the derivative of the action of a single eigenvalue, which you are basically integrating here from, say, from infinity, or this 2 times the integral from infinity, to the critical point, say, the original critical point, ai. So you think of this b cycle, it consists of 2 parts, then we go from infinity to the cut, and then you go back. These are just the same, so you get twice the integral from infinity to the cycle. So let me just sketch it here. This is the complex x-plane. Here was the branch cut, and we do this integral here. So say we integrate from let's integrate from infinity to here. Let's integrate the other way around. So what are we doing? We are taking a matrix which has rank n plus 1. We consider the extra eigenvalue, it was at infinity, and we just bring it here. So what we just have done, we have raised the rank of the matrix by 1. Just added an extra eigenvalue. So what we are computing here is kind of the difference, if you wish, of the partition function or the free energy with n eigenvalues for n plus 1 minus n, and that's just we're changing the free energy by the number of eigenvalues, and if you follow through all the, there's also an extra factor g string here, and that makes sure that it's actually df, the si, where si is actually the regularized number of eigenvalues. So these are very important relations, because these are the special geometry relations. So what did we have? We had a Riemann surface together with a one form, and then we have a function f, so I should call it f0 because it's the tree-level partition function, that was determined by the conditions that the A cycles were determined and the integrals over the B cycles were df0. Yeah, sorry. So if you wish, it's a classical variation of Hodge structures, but now for, so we know how we do get this. This is the variation of Hodge structures for the non-compact Calabi-Yau threefold given by the equation ZW plus Y squared minus W prime squared minus F equal to 0. So this function here particularly is an example of this general algebraic curve that we get. So you see, and this was the result obtained with Kumun-Wafa 2 years ago, that if you compute matrix integrals, you naturally reduce to the variations of Hodge structures of this particular class of non-compact Calabi-Yaus. In fact, we can do a little bit more, because this was all kind of tree level, but now you can ask, what about if we do the full quantum theory? So by which I mean, don't take the large n limit, but consider this limit, this integral, in the expansions in factors of g string, or if you wish, in factors of 1 over n, but keeping n finite. So the first thing is to look a little bit closer at this one form, y of x. So remember, it was of the form w prime x plus 2g string trace 1 over x minus phi. But also remember that the original path integral, e to the f, was given by d phi exponent trace of this of sum tn trace phi to the n. So you look at it, you see that you can rewrite this in another way. The first term I can write in terms of these coefficients tn as n times tn x to the n minus 1. And the second term I actually can write as, I think, 2g string squared d dtn of the function f. Why is that? Well, if we differentiate f, you see that what you are getting, so if you compute the derivative of f with respect to tn, what you are actually computing with the factor of g string, you're computing the average of trace phi to the n. So these are just the moments of the matrix. Right, so you have this ensemble of matrices. Now, in this ensemble, you can compute the moments of trace phi to the n, and they just given with respect to the derivatives of tn. So here, what I now want to do, I want to think of these tn's. So think of these tn's now as formal variables. That at the end of the calculation, we will put most of them to zero. So if we put the first d coefficients to a non-zero value, we're describing an algebraic curve of degree 2d, a hyperelliptic curve. But you can still consider all the other coefficients as formal variables that at the end of the day are putting equal to zero. So you get an expression like this, and this is closely connected to the theory of the free field. So let me remind you that if you have this free field, d phi of x, given as a, in its usual mode expansion, if you have this free field and now you consider a coherent state, so this is something I explained also yesterday, so coherent state is just an expression of the form Tn alpha minus n on 0. So on a coherent state, the alpha n's will actually be given by Tn and alpha minus n, so n is here positive, will be given by ddTn, perhaps with a coefficient n, I should be careful. So you see that if you have a coherent state, the alphas actually create our multiplication by the coefficient t of derivative respect to t. And so if you now compare with the equation that I put up there, you can actually now make the following correspondence. So you can identify this expression with the one form yx dx that I have been writing down. And you see actually that in this case, the this one form y of x actually plays the role of our field. So this is the so we now identified it as a quantum field, and this is, want to think of this kind of collective field of the matrix model. So you see that also in the full matrix model, it's very natural to write it in the quantum field. And now you can again look at the solution. So what is the solution? Of the matrix model. So now not in a large n limit, but for finite n. Well, it takes the following form. So I'm now using this identification that I want to write y as del phi, so we keep on writing this. So now there is a natural stress tensor associated. So there's a stress tensor t, which is del phi squared. And that's a famous quantum field. It has an expansion of the form ln x to the minus n minus 2. And this generates the Virasoro algebra. So the ln's have a commutation relation, which is n minus m, ln plus m. And then there's a 112 n squared minus n, m delta n plus n comma 0. So it's the famous Virasoro algebra. That's now generated by this object as a quantum field. And so the algebraic curve that I remind you was of the form y squared equals w prime squared plus f, but this is just for some general polynomial of degree 2d. So this algebraic relation that we found in the semi-classical limit, if you write the full loop equations, actually gets translated by something else, namely it gets translated by the following thing. So let me write the good notation. So the first thing is that the free energy, Z, or e to the f, can be written as an inner product between a coherent state and another state that I will call sigma, where sigma is a state in the Fock space of this Gaussian field. So f is the span of all the operators alpha minus n1 up to alpha minus ns acting on the vacuum. So this is the usual free Fock space for a free bosonic scalar field. So there's a certain state here such that the inner product with the coherent state and sigma gives the partition function z. And yes? Yes. Yeah, so it's good. So there are g string. So in this case, I think this should be, yeah, so this should be g string squared here, I think. So the important thing is that alpha, the commit, say, for those who understand, so this, these are kind of the closed string fields, and so some kind of the H bar that is controlling this theory is g string squared. It's the closed string interaction. Yeah, so I think this would be g string squared there, like this was there upstairs in that equation. Yeah, precisely. So you see the positive modes are the coefficients of the potential. The negative modes are in the way that the free energy depends on the TMs. And that's actually consistent with this general picture of the A and the B cycles for Calabi-Yau geometries, because you remember one are the periods, the other are the variations of the function in the periods. It's very similar like this. And actually, I can make this even much more precise, because the way in which this has to do, so even at this semi-classical limit, remember that we have this curve y as a function of x. And so what we're just writing there is that for large values of x, when x becomes large, then the leading coefficients, which are the Tn's, which are kind of blow up at infinity, they determine the asymptotic shape of the curve. But the subdominants, so the things that go to zero, are determined by the fact that this is an algebraic variety. That's an algebraic curve. And so the geometry itself fixes how it depends. Oh, sorry, I forgot some very important piece. Of course, here it is. Yes, sorry about that. Yes, okay. That explains it. Yes. Yeah, so the point is the following, that so now we don't have a curve. Sorry? Yes, definitely. Yeah, if you want to, it's a little bit like holography here, because you write the whole solution in terms of its boundary data. Yes. So what you find here now is that instead of giving an algebraic curve, you get something else, namely you get a state sigma in this Hilbert space, this Fock space, and the state is now determined by an equation, and the equation that's determined by is that it's satisfies a very non-trivial action of this Virasoro algebra. So this is what are usually called the Virasoro constraints. That can be written in two ways, so two equivalent ways. So one way to write this is that if you have these generators of the Virasoro algebra, which clearly, I mean, this whole F is a representation of the Virasoro algebra, that the coefficients Ln with n greater or equal to minus 1 annihilate the state. And the other way to say it is if you look at the expectation value of the stress tensor. So remember, this is now the expectation value of this quantum field yx. That will, in general, so be defined. So this thing is defined by writing not the inner product, but T and sigma, but now writing Tx in between. So that's the expectation value of the operator T of x. That this is now a polynomial function. So this is polynomial. That is to say, in general, this expression would have modes. So this would be sum if you just expand. This would be a Laurent series, so it has both positive and negative powers of x. But the statement is that this expectation value of y squared only has positive powers. And of course, in the limit, so in the classical limit, we can write the expectation value of y squared as the expectation value of y squared, and then you find the algebraic curve, right? Then you find y squared equal this polynomial of 2D plus x. So it's kind of nice that here you see also a very explicit way what we mean by quantizing the geometry, namely the classical geometry given by this relation gets now replaced by some kind of expectation value in a quantum field. So any questions about this point? Yeah, so well, that's something I come now to, yes. So what this means is that there is, for matrix models, there's a very natural way to quantize these surfaces, but in some sense, what you now want to do is forget about the matrix models and try to do this in a much more general fashion. So clearly, there's also... a relation with integrable systems, so let me just mention that also. Where's my mouse? Yes. They say this is all directly related to the theory of integrable systems. And the relation with the integrable system is the following. So in general, what you do, so let me give the simplest possible example, which is the Korteweg-de Vries, the KdV hierarchy. So, you know, the KdV equation is something which is written in terms of some function u of x, and then you write... So this is u of x, but it also depends on an infinite set of other parameters. And then the KdV equation is something like du dt1 equals u prime, but this is with respect x, plus 1/6 u triple prime, etc. There's a whole class of these equations. And the modern way to look at these hierarchies is, again, in terms of tau functions. So what are the tau functions that come to it? So tau functions are actually, so now we have all the definitions already on the blackboard, so we can write it directly. So a tau function tau of this t is nothing but an inner product of the way we just wrote down. So it's a coherent state kind of wedged with a state in this Fock space F, but the sigma is a general, is not a general element. Namely, it's an element given in so-called in the Grassmannian. And so one way to describe it is in terms of the Bose-Fermi correspondence. So what we do is we write our scalar fields d phi of x in terms of fermions. So this is the usual correspondence between bosons and fermions. E to the phi minus phi. And psi and psi dagger are two-dimensional fermions. So psi of x has the usual expansion psi n and psi x dagger has a similar expansion. And then the non-trivial anti-commutation relations are the ones between the psi's and the psi daggers. And then the space in the Grassmannian, so one way to now think about this is a natural action kind of GL infinity that acts on these modes psi n. And what you now want to do is you want to look at the orbit of the vacuum state under that Grassmannian. So that gives you a particular class of state sigma. And whenever the general theory of these integrable systems is that whenever you have such a state, then you can make this tau function. And whenever you have the tau function, then you can see that it's, for instance, if you form out of tau, you can get this u by taking the second derivative of the log of the tau function. There are various relations to compute the hierarchy in terms of the tau function. There's one more extra ingredient I have to mention here, which is a very nice way to think of this bosonization. So in particular, so there are these following choice of coordinates, which are called usually Mima-Kontsevich coordinates. Namely, let these coefficients Tn not be arbitrary, but let they be parameterized in the following way, 1 over n, sum from, say, from k to, let's call this m, of some powers of some variable, so let's call it xk to the power m. And often it's convenient to think of these x's as the eigenvalue of a matrix and write this as, oh, sorry, what I'm writing, to the power n, 1 over n, hope this is visible, trace x to the n. So suppose we decide to parameterize our coefficients Tn in this fashion. So then you can ask what happens with the coherent state. And it's a kind of nice exercise to check that the coherent state in this basis now becomes of the following form. It precisely becomes the a product of m of these fermionic operators acting on the vacuum. In fact, strictly speaking, only the kind of the creation part of it, of these operators. So by just choosing a different parameterization of these coordinates, Tn, you actually also immediately write it in a fermionic language. So that's an important ingredient, because that we can also do in the string theory. So I want to take you through that, and then we were able to actually write some very nice closed expressions of certain of these tau functions. So here I have to say something about open strings and deep brains. And let me again give a very brief summary of what I explained yesterday. So remember, in general, we are given this Riemann surface sigma. And this Riemann surface, I should stress, is always something that comes out in, so this geometry here, some explicit geometry, that only is visible in the limit where our quantization parameter GS is going to zero. Think again of the matrix model. If you want to derive this curve, you had to take the semi-classical expansion. If you didn't do that, you had to work with this full tau function, this full hierarchy. So we take this, we first think in this limit where G string is very small, and then we have this Riemann surface. And now it's possible to put D brains here. And D brains in this description are a very simple form, but what they do, they are just points. So I will draw a little line to indicate that something is sticking out of the Riemann surface, but as far as the Riemann surface itself concerned, it's just something that sits at the point P1. And here's another D brain sitting at the point PM. And the fundamental property of these D-brains was the following thing. So this, I'll review what I saw yesterday, that if you contour integrate y dx, which again was the contour integral of this d phi, del phi, around one of these points pi, then this is proportional to g string. Now, this, at this moment, you aren't really surprised anymore. So one way to think about it is that this was the property that we had for the eigenvalues of a matrix. So one thing that you can also think about is take a rank n matrix. Take n large so that you get a Riemann surface out, and now consider a few more eigenvalues. And then they will, what they will do, they will create little singularities. So what this tells you here is that the one form y of x is no longer smooth anymore, but it gets a first order pole. So we see here that including a D-brain, say at, suppose the point P is given, is the point where this variable x is x0, then our meromorphic one form, y dx, will shift to y dx plus g string over x minus x0. So it just gets an extra pole. So just creating by hand poles at these locations is equivalent to including D-brains in the system. And so there are, again, two things you can say. The first thing, which is, I think is very nice, is this tells you that for the string theorists here, that including a D-brain is equivalent to modifying the geometry, namely precisely in this fashion. So if you think of kind of our curve, y as a function of x, we see that if we put a D-brain at x0, then the curve will modify. Namely, what will happen is that it will kind of create a pole. And perhaps even better to draw this in complex coordinates. So if this is the complex x-plane, then the moment we put a D-brain there, it kind of creates an infinite deep throat. So if you wish, it's kind of a caricature of a black hole or something. You could just modify the geometry in a very strict way. But so this is what happens in classical geometry. But we also know that how to do this in quantum field theory. So how do we modify the background of a quantum field? Remember, y dx is now the quantum field d phi. such that it creates a first order pole, and that's precisely by including a fermion. So psi of x, psi, if you put psi x0 in the background del phi, then this will have a first order pole psi x0. So that's another kind of general result here, that these D-brains are equivalent to putting fermions. In fact, we can ask, what again is the classical effect of putting these fermions? Yeah, I guess in some sense you cannot really, if you try to put two first order poles on top of each other or something, it's kind of natural that the thing kind of bubbles off, and that you have, that they're still kind of on a separate piece of complex plane, but are separate. You can't really create a double order pole. So one thing that this tells you in particular, that for instance, if you want to compute the one point function of such a fermion, so okay, let's do it more general. So now we can compute, say we have these fermions, say at position x1 to xn. So what is this? Well, we know on the one hand, this is just the evaluation of the tau function, where we pick particular values for these tn's. So the tn's are now given by the formula I just wrote down, this xa to the power n. So by picking these kind of special coordinates, it just means that instead of looking at the general element here, we're just looking at these endpoint functions of fermions. So that's the one thing. And you can also see what the leading contributions are, because the leading contribution for the psi of x is just that it's kind of e to the phi of x, where you compute phi in terms of d phi, as I just wrote down. But there's a much nicer point of view, namely that this correlation function of D-brains, so this would also be given by a matrix model. So I clearly have not time enough to explain how to do this in detail, but so let me just finish by giving you one very simple example. So it's basically the simplest possible example I can consider. And that's the following form. So remember, in general, we have these Calabi-Yau threefolds, and they have the form ZW plus some function of x and y. And I said, well, in general, it's y squared plus some polynomial of x, where the degree of the polynomial was the number of branch points. But now, let's kind of, so we have, in general, many branch points. But let's now kind of take a magnifying glass and look in the neighborhood of a single branch point. So it's the simplest possible geometry we can take. So what does it mean? That means that we just have a linear function here. So how does our curve look like? Our curve looks something like this. Right? So this is the real slice of the curve around a single branch point. And so we're looking at the neighborhood here of this point. So in this case, there are kind of two ways to look at the model. So you can either look at it, so in some sense, of course, here there is a kind of symmetry. We either can think of y as a function of x, or we can think of x as a function of y. And both are good. It's just kind of which kind of coordinate we want to pick. And the thing I want to do here is that I want to kind of take this point of view. So I want to write x as kind of del phi of y. That's what I want to do. So this is very simple. It starts off with y squared. And then perhaps we want to include all kind of further perturbations. So now we want to look at the, so if you now put a D-brain, then the action of the D-brain, so it will contribute to the action as e to the phi. Remember, phi is just the action of, in some sense, of a single eigenvalue. And phi is here clearly the integral of y squared, so it goes like y cubed. So in this case, the single eigenvalue will go like y cubed. So now the question is, what happens if we put more than one d-brain? So now suppose we put kind of n of these d-brains. Well, a general principle in closed open dualities is that this model will be described by a rank n matrix model. So what would the matrix model be? Well, it would be an integral, say, of a matrix Y. So this is M by M matrix. And then we have to put an action. And I'm afraid I don't have enough time to really explain to you in full detail how this action is derived. But roughly, it should be an analog of this action Y cubed. In fact, what it turns out to be is the trace of y cubed, a very natural thing. And then also you have to write down something which gives you the positions of the d-brains. So let the d-brains be sitting at x1 up to xn. So that's the position of the d-brains. Then you get here a term x times y. So this is something you can kind of rigorously derive just using the open strings. And so the claim is now that this integral over here is the same thing as this tau function T of sigma, where the Tn's are given in terms of this formula x to the n. This integral looks infinite? So again, okay, so this is, so it's in the space, so it's integrated around a cycle inside the space of n by n complex matrices. So it's a higher order analog of the Airy function. And again, you have to pick your contour appropriately. And of course, this should be also a 1 over G string. So this is kind of a famous matrix model. So this is called the Kontsevich matrix model. And it's something that Kontsevich introduced when he wanted to compute intersection numbers on the modulized space of curves a long time ago, almost 15 years ago. And it was always, I mean, it's kind of interesting to stress the following thing. So we have two various objects, you know, in my equation. So I told you here is the Riemann surface. And that Riemann surface can be obtained by taking the limit n to infinity from some matrix model. And I went through the manipulations that we have to do to this matrix model. We really had to send large n to build this Riemann surface. And then we could look like at general correlation functions with this Riemann surface. So now what you can do that in this background, you can put m of the d-brains. And that by itself should also be given by a matrix model. But the important thing is this is a finite dimensional matrix model. I mean, we could, for instance, take the rank to be here 1. And it would still make sense. So what you find is that these kind of solutions, so you find something very important, which actually generalizes in a rather grand way, is that the thing that we had here, which was a tau function, in this very simple case, it turns out to be a tau function of the KdV hierarchy, that these tau functions can on the one hand be obtained in this limit when n is very large of matrix models. We also saw that the way in which we should think about them are quantum versions of Riemann surfaces, where in some sense we are quantizing the variations of the shape of the Riemann surface, the variations of the complex structure. But we also find that if we pick a particular choice for our coefficients, which correspond to basically putting on this Riemann surface a one form which has n different extra first order poles, that this modified geometry is then captured again by a finite rank matrix model. And I think that's kind of very nice because it ties together for instance, two very different ways in which matrix models are related to integral hierarchies. So I think that I find pretty satisfying. And this actually, as I say, generalizes in a very broad sense. So there is a, there are many Riemann surfaces and, of course, also full Calabi-Yau threefolds that can be obtained not as limits of matrix models. So we can kind of forget this connection and just develop the theory of these quantum Riemann surfaces or quantum Calabi-Yaus. And we can put d-brains on the quantum Calabi-Yaus and compute the analog of these matrix models that appear on the left-hand side. And this seems to kind of generalize in a very broad sense. So, well, I only have given you here a tip of the iceberg, unfortunately. So it's a field which has, I think, one of the nice things, I'm very happy to give you these lectures about topological strings. So it's something that I started working on in 89, and I've done many different things in between. But if I would have given, in retrospect, if I would go with a time machine back to that time and would give a student an advice what would be a good field to work on, I would have advised this work, this field, because I think this topological strings has roughly every year there has been another breakthrough, and I think it's a very rich field, and I think also we are still very much struggling to find kind of a, well, kind of a grand vision on where the field is going towards. But I think it's tying together all kind of interesting branches of mathematics, only giving you a few examples of this. But I was quite honored to give these talks, and I want to thank you for the hospitality here. And I want to finish at this point. Thank you.
How large is the iPhone?
Sorry?
How large?
Yeah, is there a Titanic or something? I don't know. So I think actually what I feel is that we are in a very clumsy way. For instance, the way we are talking about Calabi-Yau manifolds or something, I feel is a very, very clumsy way to do this. So I think, for instance, the example I mentioned in my first lecture, where you have these very difficult problems of doing intersection theory on the moduli space of curves, and in the end it's rather trivial combinatorics. What this, I think, is hinting to me at least, is that these are problems that you shouldn't think, for instance, in terms of Riemann surfaces. So this started off as string theory, but I think actually doing this as on the string theory is like almost the most difficult way to do. So in some sense, I feel that I wouldn't be surprised if there, in a few years we have a completely different point of view on all of this, and nobody will mention strings, but something else. So I actually expect quite a big chunk to be below the surface. No. Yeah, so okay, so one thing that you have to do, so in some sense all of this is really related to the fact that you could project down to two dimensions. And this is also related if you go to the A-model that you have to hold the toric situation. So I think in general what you will have to do is you would, so one way to think about it, these are kind of, so there's this way of thinking of Calabi-Yaus as T3 vibrations with singularities, so with a three-dimensional, real three-dimensional base with singularities. And so, in some sense, this is all kind of a two-dimensional theory. I think we should kind of live through three-dimensional theory. We actually have three-dimensional structures. And in some sense, it's quite straightforward you have to do. You have basically, okay, one thing that you have to do, you have to use these structures here, but you also have to use the mirror of the structure at the same time. And so somehow you have to be able to glue these two things together. And I think actually that I don't see why this isn't feasible in some sense. So then I think actually if you do that, you can actually build compact manifolds, like the quintic or something. And they would again would be given by this combinatorial data. So I think that's my hope to, in the end, build compact cases in this way.
Okay, let's thank you.